10 together, please. Psalm 10. Well, as Bruce's Lord's Supper talk gave ready introduction, over the last few weeks we have been talking about humility and exaltation and trying to understand what it biblically means to be humble. And indeed, humility is neither pride nor shame, but it's an openness to grace. This morning, what I'd like to do is just offer this series a tentative close and consider the mask of pride and shame. Let me say that another way. How do pride and shame disguise themselves as one another? As I reflected on our classes over the last 3 weeks, this has been a theme that has come up every single week. And I really wanted to go biblically back into the text and consider how pride and shame often disguise themselves one another. And hopefully in the process, we will come to see ourselves more fully and also the grace of God in a greater extent. So here's where we are. Humility is not to be confused with shame. And as I argued 3 weeks ago, I think many Christians falsely equate shame with humility. Whenever you're shameful, you think that you're nothing. When you're full of pride, you think you're everything. When you're humble, you're open to receiving the grace of others. Much as in Luke 14, don't go sit in the highest place, nor stay in the lowest place, but be invited to the highest place. That's humility. And over the last few weeks, we've really tried to understand what humility shows us about grace and what humility should show us about our gifts and about even our own selves. But this morning, let's ask, how does shame disguise itself as pride? Indeed, if we are going to be humble, we must be neither shameful nor prideful. Therefore, we must not have shame disguised as pride, nor should we have pride disguised as shame, but we should be humble. So let's consider Psalm 10 together and ask, how does shame disguise itself as pride? Psalm 10. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul. The one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocents. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like a lion in the thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws them out into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. He says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. In this psalm, David, we know this is David because Psalm 9 and Psalm 10 were originally written together. Psalm 9 is given to us. In this psalm, David is recounting an enemy who has pridefully exalted himself over David. And you'll notice from verse 2 down through verse 11 of this psalm, David gives almost every single insult that you could possibly give to one who is oppressing you. David says of the arrogant man in verse 2, in arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Verse 3, for the wicked boast of the desires of his soul. Verse 6, he says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Verse 7, his mouth is filled with cursing, deceit, and oppression. Verse 9, he lurks in ambush like a lion in a thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. You'll notice David has nothing at all complimentary to say of this proud individual, or perhaps even this class of proud individuals. But I would like to ask, why is this adversary filled with pride and arrogance and violence and deceit and oppression? Well, on the surface, you'll notice this is a man who seems to be filled with pride, right? If you had to chart where David is placing his adversary here, obviously his adversary is not humble. But where then do we put his adversary? I would recommend we actually need to start with shame. If you notice verse 4, in the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Now, let's pause here for a moment. If I would have asked you, as I just did again, where would you have placed this individual on the chart? I would say all of us would have said, oh, this is the proud individual. He needs to be right here on top. He's proud. He's arrogant. He thinks he can exalt himself over other people. That's the disguise that this individual's wearing. But in his heart, in his inside, what is he really? In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. Verse 11, he says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. What is actually motivating this opponent to accuse and deceive and slander and persecute? He works under the assumption that either God does not exist or God has forgotten us. His face has been hidden from us. He will never see it. What's actually driving this man? A sense that there is no God. A sense that there is no purpose. A sense that there is no meaning. And because there is no God, because there is no purpose, because there is no meaning, what then is left? Nothing. I would argue that really this man's core problem is shame. Because whenever you cut off your creator from your existence, you're left with nothingness. And that has been the fate of Western philosophy ever since the Enlightenment. Nietzsche, etc., have lied to us and told us that there is no creator, or the gods are so far removed they have no concern for us. And because God does not exist, we are left with nothingness. Shame. And in the shame, what then do we do? We seek to exalt ourselves in pride over others. You'll notice verse 10, the helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by their might. Verse 3, the wicked boast of the desires of his soul. The one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. So let's explain this a bit more clearly. I think in Psalm 10 what you see is shame disguising itself as pride. Okay? Shame disguising itself as pride. This was so tangled in my head the other night, I had to reach out to Ben for help. And he really helped me untangle this. So let's keep these disguises about. This is shame disguising itself as pride. But what does that look like in life? If you think back to the Andy Griffith Christmas episode with old Ben, it's the best episode of the whole series in my opinion. What does old Ben try to do there? For those of you who've never seen it, why not? Spend your afternoon productively and watch it. But here's the very brief synopsis of what happens. You have a store owner who tries to have other citizens of the town arrested and accused, and he tries to be malicious against them. And as you watch the episode the whole time, you're like, Ben is just very proud. He's an arrogant man. He is trying to have this poor family crushed under his feet. He is trying to crush the poor under him. The helpless are crushing down, fall by his might. But then as the episode progresses, you learn, why does Ben actually do this? Because he's actually really lonely. He has nobody. He has no purpose. He has nothing fulfilling in his life. And then as you strip away the mask of his pride, what's actually left? Shame. How would I describe Ben? That's really confusing because I just talked about you, didn't I? Yeah, how would I describe Ben Kimball? Put it on the record. This is shame disguising itself as pride. Because here's what old Ben does. Old Ben has nobody. Old Ben is lonely. Old Ben is helpless. And because he is shameful, because he is nothing, he then tries to exalt himself over other people. Shame masked as pride. But let's look at the other side of this. How does pride disguise itself as shame? How does pride disguise itself as shame? For this, I want to go down to Psalm 13. Again, a psalm of David. Look at Psalm 13. Psalm 13. To the choir master, a psalm of David. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. Your heart shall rejoice in salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. Now, this psalm, even though it's short, has three movements to it. In verses 1 and 2, he's posing the questions and the dilemmas of the psalm. In questions 3 and 4, he's confronting the problem of the psalm. And then in verses 5 and 6, he's recounting the praise of God in the psalm. For those of y'all that listened to Tommy Peeler's lesson that I sent, this is a psalm that moves from lament to praise. He begins with lament and then is taken to praise. But I want to ask you now, in this psalm, how would we describe David? In Psalm 10, we were talking about David's opponent. Here, how would we describe David? Is David proud? Is David shameful? Or is David humble? Let's reread the psalm, the short one. Verse 1. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemies be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord, my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. How would you describe David in the psalm? On the surface, we would probably say shameful. On the surface, it seems like David is shameful. How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? My enemies have prevailed over me. My foes have shaken me. My eyes have slept the sleep of death. These are all the manifestations of shame. But I think if we go down a bit further, we actually see that David's problem here is not truly shame, but David's true problem here is pride. Why? Notice verse 2. How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Let's put this in our own words. Nobody has ever suffered like I have. Nobody understands what I'm going through. Nobody has ever been through what I've been through. How long, O Lord, will you forget me? Because nobody has ever been forgotten by God as much as I have been forgotten. No one has ever been forsaken as much as I've been forsaken. No one has ever suffered as much as I have ever suffered. Is that pride or shame? That's pride. And because David is filled with pride, what then does it manifest itself as? Shame. Which is why he says in verse 4, my enemies have prevailed over me. Using the words of the day, my enemies have exalted themselves over me, and my foes have rejoiced because I am shaken. What's the problem? David appears shameful, but his problem is really pride. Now, I would like to read a few sections from the article that I sent out last week. Earlier this year, it was dated back in February, I'd read this article and just, I've been sitting on it and thinking about it ever since and just didn't have a good time to work it in. But the title of the article was called The Seductive Sin We Never Talk About. It's provocative, right? What's the seductive sin we never talk about? Quote, self-pity starts with pity. The virtue of showing sympathy and seeking understanding. When pity turns inward, it diminishes compassion for others and makes selflessness harder to come by. How does self-pity relate to pride? It's the flip side of boasting. Boasting is the response of pride to success. Self-pity is the response of pride to suffering. I have a few more things I'd like to read, but let's really simmer on this quote for a second. Putting it in my own words, this is what I would recommend. Boasting is shame disguised as pride. Self-pity is pride disguised as shame. Let's rework through my examples for a moment. Boasting is shame disguised as pride. What about old Ben? Old Ben really is shameful in his heart. Old Ben thinks that nobody likes him. Old Ben thinks that he has nobody. Old Ben is actually filled with shame. What then does that shame manifest itself as? Pride, exalting himself over other people. Now take the flip side of this. What about self-pity? As you think through the series, who would come to mind? Who would come to mind? A great many characters. But you think about the episode when Ellie comes to town. And, oh, her name's escaping me at the moment. Gracious me. When Ellie comes to town and refuses to give the medicine. I'm sure somebody can tell this to me afterward and tell it to me in class. It's totally escaped my mind right now. But when Ellie comes to town and refuses to give the medicine, and this lady is just convinced that she's going to die because she doesn't have her medicine, ends up being sugar water. What's her problem? It seems like shame, but what's her real problem? Pride. Nobody understands me. No one's ever suffered like I have. No one's ever had pain like I do. No one's ever had the ways and circumstances that I have had. It's actually pride. Let me keep reading from the article. Boasting is the response of pride to success. Self-pity is the response of pride to suffering. Boasting says, I deserve admiration because how much I have achieved. Self-pity says, I deserve admiration because I have suffered so much. Boasting is the voice of pride in the heart of the strong. Self-pity is the voice of pride in the heart of the weak. Boasting sounds self-sufficient. Self-pity sounds self-sacrificing. Boasting is usually obvious. But self-pity is more subtle. It arises from the wounded ego. The self-pitiful often appear as if they struggle with low esteem or feelings of unworthiness. In reality, people will wallow in self-pity. They are unhappy because their worthiness of suffering has gone unnoticed. Again, in reality, people who wallow in self-pity are unhappy because their worthiness of suffering has gone unnoticed. I haven't received what I owe, so I deserve better. No one treats me according to my worth. Now let me preach to the heart of Ryan for a moment. I have been guilty of both. Certainly in my life, I have been guilty of boasting. And when I think back, especially to days in school, when I wanted to be the top of the class, the desire to be on top sounds like pride, but actually where'd that come from? A place of insecurity, a place of shame. In my own life, especially academically, the desire to be exalted over other people really came from an insecurity on my own self and a real lack of humility. And I have boasted. But I've also wallowed away in self-pity in my life. No one understands what I have been through. Probably the time in my life most was whenever the twins were between about 1 to 6 months. I am a crank box when I do not get my 8 hours. I have to get sleep. And Jessica will tell you, I have to get sleep. And I can remember wallowing away in my self-pity many days. No one has ever been as tired as I have been. No one has ever been as sleepy as I am. No one understands how overwhelmed and stressed and busy and exhausted that I am. It sounds like shame, but what's the real problem? Pride. God forgive me. God make me righteous. Now, my brothers and sisters in Christ, siblings in the family, let's ask ourselves, which ones are we guilty of? I noticed, especially with this second one, a lot of y'all starting to elbow people sitting right beside you. Boy, that's Aunt Kathy that we had to be around last week, isn't it? I don't have an Aunt Kathy, which is why I'm perfectly fine saying that. But especially self-pity. Whoo, that's easy to see in family, isn't it? Somebody who just likes to gripe about how bad they have it and how nobody understands them and woe is me. Or an uncle as well, Ben. But what about our own selves? What about our own hearts? Have we committed boasting? And have we been self-pitiful? Well, that's the bad news. What's the good news? As we go back to the Psalms, we're going to note the answer to both of these, of course, is grace. What is the way out of pride and shame in Luke 14? It's grace. In Luke 19, it's grace. In Psalm 10 and Psalm 13, it's grace. Notice back in the Psalms with me again. In Psalm 10, verse 11, it says, he says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. The same problem is in 13:1. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? The problem of both Psalms is actually the face of God appears hidden. How long, O God, will your face remain hidden from me? Now, Al called me about 9:30 on Wednesday, and he said, Ryan, I'm sorry to call so late. That's not late, Al. I'm just getting started. And said, you talked about in class that no man's ever seen God's face, but then the face of Christ was in the Transfiguration. Where was that? I love whenever y'all keep thinking about class and studies after it's over. And I love getting 11 o'clock text about this stuff and phone calls at whatever time. I love that. So Al, do not ever apologize for that. But here was Al's question. In Matthew 17, this is our study on Wednesday night, Jesus' face was transfigured, and yet in the Old Testament it says God's face has never been seen. My very short explanation to this is in Exodus 33, it says Moses talked to God as a man speaks to a friend face to face, and yet later in Exodus 33, it says, same chapter, no one can ever see God's face and live. To me, that's like asking, have you ever seen the sun? Andy, have you ever seen the sun? No, you haven't. You've been right up to the face of the sun, and you've seen the face of the sun? That's like seeing God's face, right? We have seen the face of God, but we have not really seen the face of God. On these Psalms, the problem is twofold. Not only have we not seen God's face, but we've not even seen the appearance of God's face. God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. What then is the solution? The revelation of God's own face. The revelation of God's own self. Psalm 13, verse 5. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. When we wallow away in self-pity, and when we are caught up in boasting, our hearts need to be brought out of the pits by the face of God. If you'll look at a few passages with me in the book of Matthew, we read from Matthew chapter 17 on Wednesday night when we were discussing the transfiguration. And notice Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up to a high mountain by themselves. He was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. The face of Christ shined. The face of Christ shined. And what does the face of Christ shine against? Every form of pride. Because Peter, who, of course, Peter wants to build 3 different tents, what then does he do? The Lord Jesus Christ, with his face that was shining, comes down with an unlit face and says, "Rise and have no fear." The pride of Peter meets the face of Christ. But then as you look over to Matthew 26, you'll notice the face of Christ is in a very different posture. In Matthew chapter 26, verse 39... Matthew chapter 26, verse 39. And going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." What does the face of Christ meet? The face of Christ is thrown to the ground by the suffering of the cosmos. The suffering of Christ is thrown to the face of this earth by the pain and the shame of this world. And even as you look down to verse 67 of the chapter, "Then they spat in his face and struck him, and some slapped him." Here, what does the face of Christ meet? The shame of the world. Isn't that interesting? In Matthew 17, the face of Christ is confronting pride. But in Matthew 26, the face of Christ is confronting shame. In Jesus Christ, the face of God has been revealed. In Jesus Christ, the very essence, the very nature of our triune God has been made manifest. And for us to be taken out of boasting, for us to be lifted out of self-pity, we must look to the face of Christ. Because the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. Oh, I love this passage. "In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shown the light in the heart." Let me repeat this. I'm doing my own translation. "Has shown in our hearts to give the light of the glory of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ." What does that mean? That means that if I think that I am exalted over other people, let us look to the face of Christ, being humbled, receiving God's grace. If I am shamefully wallowing in self-pity, look to the face of Christ and be exalted into humiliation. Be exalted into humility. Hopefully that paradox makes sense now. Neither pride nor shame, nor pride disguised as shame, nor shame disguised as pride should be the categories of God's people. But God's people should be humble. God's people should be filled with grace. God's people, having looked upon the face of God and the manifestation of Jesus Christ, should be receptive to the grace of God. Let us be humble. Thank you. You can be preparing for the invitation at this time. I'd like to close by reading a couple of passages that we've just read again. Psalm 10, verse 17. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. In 2 Corinthians 4, the light of God has shone into our hearts. In Psalm 10 and Psalm 13, the psalmist is beseeching God, strengthen and give steadfast assurance and salvation to our hearts. The call of the psalmist has been fulfilled. God has established our hearts, leaving us not in pride, leaving us not in shame, but humbly allowing us to receive the gift of God's grace. And because God has acted first, creating us, and yet in the face of rebellion, providing for us, with his Son having given the sacrifice and the Spirit continuing to give regeneration, we can humbly receive that gift, turning our faithfulness outside of ourselves into the very presence of God, repenting of the past self unto the new self, confessing Jesus Christ with word and deed as the Messiah, and being immersed from the old Adam to the new, from death to life. Our God is ready to respond. If anyone needs the gospel call this morning, I ask you to come forward as we stand and sing.